Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Yet another moment of truth for Greece. The Greek parliament is due to vote tomorrow on another package of spending cuts and tax increases. If it's approved, European governments will come through with another economic bailout. In Washington, meanwhile, it's high noon in the fight over the debt ceiling. With all the fiery rhetoric, what are the chances for a sober discussion of the policy issues? Our guests today are discouraged. This hour on Point, finding the right way forward from Greece to Washington. You can join the conversation. Are you paying attention to the budget battles in Washington and over in Europe? Are you hearing real solutions? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Simon Johnson. He's a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, now a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management, and is the author of 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown. Simon, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be with you.
Let's start with Greece, Simon. There seems to be a repetitive quality about the news on bailing out Greece. Are we really getting anywhere? Are these measures just a matter of buying time? How do you see it?
Well, there's certainly an element of trying to buy time. The Europeans are really not prepared for a bigger crisis if Greece, for example, were to default. I would say the Europeans have studiously avoided preparing for the past 2 years. That's why they're not prepared now. But still, they really, really don't want bad events, Greece to miss payments, Greece to say it's in default, or the Greek government to fall.
Well, if that's what they want, what should they be doing? I mean, is this piecemeal approach, you know, what tranche of bailout money here and then a few months later something else, is that going to do it? If they are serious about avoiding a default?
Well, I don't think it's a good approach at all, and obviously it's something they've been trying for over a year now, and the fact it hasn't succeeded is what's brought us to this sort of repeated on-off crisis situation. I do think matters will come to a head over the next month or two. I do think they'll have to put a more comprehensive solution in place. Otherwise, the consequences are going to be quite bad.
Simon, let's get some definitions clear here. What really is default? If, for example, Greece's creditors agree to roll over the debt, does that constitute a default? Would that, in turn, make other investors, financial markets nervous? Or is a default something more drastic than that, when Greece simply doesn't pay what it has, what it owes?
Well, that's a very good question, actually, and well-informed people close to these kinds of events disagree for some good reasons. It's obviously, if I refuse to pay you money that I've promised to pay, that's clearly a default and a form of bankruptcy for individuals, and countries don't have a bankruptcy procedure. Perhaps they should, but they don't, and therefore you go into a default and debt negotiation type situation. But what if I offer to pay you a different amount or pay you over a longer period of time, and you agree to take those payments? Is that a default? Well, some people would say, and under some contracts, it would be if the net present value, the value today of all those future payments discounted with the appropriate interest rate, if that value has gone down, some people are going to say, oh, wait a minute, that's default. If, on the other hand, I perhaps have tweaked things a little bit, so I've pushed the payments far back into the future, and we agree on an interest rate that may or may not be the right interest rate, but that makes the net present value look okay, like it hasn't declined, then perhaps we can agree that this is a voluntary rescheduling without any kind of default. And I think that's what they're edging towards, so that it wouldn't trigger all kinds of other consequences for various kinds of credit insurance contracts, for example. They want to stay away from the default scenario.
And do you think that sort of semi-default would actually reassure them? You know, there are a lot of people who are fearing that a Greek default by some definition would be sort of analogous to the Lehman bankruptcy in 2008 and set in motion a whole terrifying chain of events. If you get this kind of modified solution, do you think that would be sufficient? And second, Simon, what do you think the chances right now of that being worked out are?
Let me take the Lehman moment point first, because that's such a huge and critical question. I think the analogy is quite a good one, actually. specifically because it wasn't just the failure of Lehman that caused dire consequences for financial markets around the world. It was how you thought about risk of various kinds of other firms, such as Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, after the collapse of Lehman. So the problem is not Greece. Greece is relatively small. Greek debt is quite small relative to the GDP of Europe, for example. The European economy, European Union, is roughly speaking the same size as the United States, about a $14 trillion economy. And with the amount of debt loss that you would have in a bad Greek scenario, could be $100 billion. Now, that's not a lot of money relative to $14 trillion. But the question is, what does it make you think will happen to Ireland, Portugal? You mentioned earlier Spain, for example. Other people mentioned Italy or Belgium. And what do you think will happen to European banks? And what, if you want to think about it from a U.S. perspective, what is the exposure of U.S. money market funds to European banks? The Wall Street Journal lead editorial this morning has some very scary numbers about the extent of that exposure. So it's the contagion in potentially unexpected and hard to control ways around the world that scares people about the Greek situation.
And one of the reasons it's hard to control is you're talking here about investors who are not under the control of any policymaking authority. If they get nervous, there's really not a whole lot you can do about it, is there?
That's right. It's a lot about confidence. It's a lot about many decentralized investment decisions. But let's be clear, Tom. This is almost 3 years after the collapse of Lehman. Nobody has made appropriate preparations for this kind of systemic risk and systemic collapse. I have the great honor of serving on the FDIC's new Systemic Resolution Advisory Committee. Actually met for the first time, just coincidentally, last week. On Tuesday, and I can say with some assurance, it's a public meeting, so people can go look at the webcast for themselves. Yeah. I'm not giving anything away. I can tell you that nobody is ready for a shock of this magnitude because the private sector has studiously not prepared, and the official sector in the United States and in Europe has also studiously not prepared.
But Simon, do we know what works? I mean, in Greece, we've had fiscal austerity, but tax revenue in Greece, tax receipts are still falling. In the United States, we've had fiscal stimulus and we've had easy money. Unemployment is still over 9%. Do we really have a good sense yet of what actually works?
Yes, we have a sense of some of the pieces that work, but there are no magic bullets, Tom. This we're coming off the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression, and I think that's a term that has been used a lot and maybe bandied around too much because we say, oh yeah, the greatest crisis, and of course we're bouncing back. Well, we're not bouncing back. We're struggling to recover. This recession in the United States looks very different from any other post-war recession because employment is still down about 5% from where it was before the peak, before the crash. Every other recession, employment has come back in 12, 18, 24 months. It's come back to its pre-crisis level. It's not coming back in the same way that the fiscal reaction in the United States that includes some discretionary stimulus, but mostly what's called automatic stabilizers, just meaning you take in less revenue and you spend more on unemployment benefits and food stamps and so on when you go into a recession. That has pushed the budget into deficit. And as the economy recovers, that deficit will go down, assuming the policymakers don't mess things up further. But this is not good. This is not a great situation because we allowed this massive financial crisis to happen. The banks blew themselves up. And the danger of the Greek situation is that you'll have some sort of echo or repeat of that, this time centered on the European banks that have very little capital. They don't have equity. They don't have buffers against losses. So they could easily find themselves being pushed to the brink of insolvency.
Now, Simon, of course, in Greece, the controversy there between the opposition and the government is whether how much of a role tax increases should be part of the solution. And that, of course, reflects the same debate here in Washington. Let's listen to a couple of the comments that have been made on this. First of all, here's Republican Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina in an interview with ABC News' John Carl on Friday.
It would be the most toxic vote we could take. If you look at the polls, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, they do not think we should increase the debt limit. And nearly 80% across party lines believe we should balance our budget.
So Republicans that go along with a debt ceiling increase are gone.
Yeah, well, I can't say that 100%, but I think based on what I can see around the country, not only are those individuals gone, but I suspect the Republican Party would be set back many years.
Well, apparently House Majority Majority Leader Eric Cantor heard that, because last Thursday he and other Republicans walked out of budget negotiations with Vice President Biden. And yesterday on CNN's State of the Union, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi had this to say about Congressman Cantor's move.
Leader Cantor can't handle the truth when it comes to these tax subsidies for big oil, for corporations sending jobs overseas, for giving tax breaks to the wealthiest people in our country.
So, Simon, you hear the politics of this going on right now. Who's in better shape here, the politicians in Europe as they debate alternatives, or the politicians here in the United States?
Well, they're all obviously in bad shape, different kinds of bad shape. The problem in the United States, Tom, is really very interesting. The debt ceiling debate, I think, is having very little impact on anything. It's a largely symbolic positioning for the 2012 presidential elections. If you look at interest rates that the Treasury pays on its 10-year bonds, for example, benchmark interest rate, this has actually gone down during all the hysterics about the debt ceiling. The markets don't believe that anyone is really going to push the U.S. into default, because that would be catastrophic for the business sector and for everybody else. The problem, I think, is that the U.S. is going to be given too much rope for too long by these forgiving financial markets and by mass amount of global savings that comes to the United States. And that will push us really into a deeper problem down the road.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gjelten, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about debt crises here in the U.S. and in Europe. Do you see Athens-style policy paralysis in Washington? Are our politicians too busy scoring points while the rest of us are headed for the rocks? My guest this hour is Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, now a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and he joins us from Washington. Simon, just at the end of the last segment, we were talking about the situations in Greece and in the United States. As you look across the different scenarios, whether it's Greece, whether it's Great Britain, whether it's the United States, what do you see in terms of the different approaches?
Well, I think we should make a very clear contrast, and maybe it's an instructive contrast, between Greece and the United States. These are two very different extremes, mostly because of the willingness of the outside world to fund big budget deficits. Actually, the numbers in terms of the deficits coming into until Greece, when it really went into the downward spiral, those numbers were roughly similar between Greece and the United States. Greece had somewhat higher debt. Greece doesn't have its own currency. It's part of the Eurozone, so that removes a policy tool, if you like. But the main problem was that people became convinced that Greece was going to have trouble paying its debt and trouble raising new money, new loans, to roll over the old loans. Interest rates went up. Then they start to cut. And once you start to make big cuts, big precipitate cuts in spending, you may want to raise taxes also, but that's hard to do when you're under this kind of pressure. Big spending cuts tend to contract the economy. Then debt to GDP goes up because GDP, the economy size, is going down. Then everyone says, oh my goodness, look at the debt to GDP numbers, and they really want to abandon ship. Then the European Union shows up with the IMF in tow to help, but the policies they want to put in place involve more spending cuts, which doesn't help your debt-to-GDP numbers, and ultimately you end up either having to restructure the Greek debt, or I think reprofiling is the polite term people use now. It's a form of default. Or all of the Greek debt will end up being held by sympathetic governments in the European Union and the IMF, and they'll roll them over indefinitely at a 2% interest rate. At 2% interest rate, almost everyone is solvent. But you don't go back to the private markets, and you still have a massive budget correction and a lot of austerity and a prolonged recession in a Greek economy that remains tied to the euro.
Of course, you say that spending cuts will contract the economy. Some economists say that tax increases will contract the economy as well. So if you're trying to get your deficit crisis under control, it's not obvious what you should do, right?
Well, it is obvious what you should do, but it's not obvious that you want to do it. You should reduce spending. You should raise taxes to some degree. If you have time, you should use that time. So the British, for example, are trying to bring their budget deficit down, and there's a lot of rhetoric about austerity and so on. But if you look at the numbers, it's a much gentler path than the Greeks have, and actually involves a lot of tax increases relative to spending cuts. That's the UK choice. The United States should also find ways to stabilize debt to GDP. We have more time because people are willing to lend us money. We're still the major reserve currency in the world, so people use the dollar and dollar assets like treasury securities to park their rainy day money. That's true of both governments and the private sector around the world. This gives us time to make fiscal adjustments, and you can adjust on the spending side and on the tax side. Most people would say you need to do a bit of both. You don't have to take precipitate, panicked action, however, because you have the time. But of course, if you don't use the time, if you use the time just for crazy symbolic rhetoric and don't actually deal with the underlying fiscal problems, eventually, yes, you are going to turn into Greece.
And I'd like to bring another guest into the conversation now. Joining us from Milan, Italy, is Michael Spence. He's a Nobel Prize-winning economist, chairman of the Commission on Growth and Development, and a distinguished fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is The Next Convergence, The Future of Economic Growth in a Multi-Speed World. Michael Spence, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So you are in Europe now, and let me ask you, do these crises look to you different from a vantage point in Europe than they would if you were back in New York or in Washington?
There may be slight differences. When you live in Europe, you get some of the flavor of the way people think about their government. I think one of the problems in Greece is that there's pretty good evidence that they're going to have trouble agreeing on an austerity package that will be acceptable to the main members of the Eurozone, like Germany. And one of the reasons is that the Greek people don't trust their government, and so they're not willing to go along. I think that's part of what's creating the uncertainty about the outcome and the risk. Greece doesn't follow through this week or next week and deal with some degree of austerity, as Simon talked about before, then the European Union and the IMF can't come in to bail them out in some kind of orderly restructuring. Greece is on its own, and I think most people agree. I certainly believe they just default.
Yeah. Now, Michael Spence, in your book, The Next Convergence, you talk a lot about the structural changes in the global economy and really present those as the big challenge, whether it's in the United States or in other countries in the developed world. You don't seem to pay as much attention to this debt issue, the debt bomb, as some people say, yet the headline in the Wall Street Journal in front of me this morning is Debt Hamstrings Recovery. In your judgment, where does the structural issues in the global economy, the shift in the type of work that is done in the United States versus what's done in other countries, how do those issues measure up against the debt issues in terms of how important they are in explaining the predicament we're in right now?
But if you focus on the United States, I mean, and Simon may disagree with some of this, I think we have the most immediate problem is that of producing a credible plan that has enough bipartisan support to be believable to stabilize the debt over a reasonable time horizon, the deficits, rather. After that, again, as Simon said, if you try to reduce the deficit so you're back to sort of relatively safe levels, let's call it 60% of GDP, that the best way to do that is to generate some growth. And that's where the other issue comes in. If you have, without taking us on a great aside, that we have structural issues to deal with respect to growth to some extent and employment to a great extent. And of course, the hope is that, the system is sophisticated enough to deal with those things simultaneously. I apologize, somebody's ringing a phone here.
Yes.
And I think I have to say that I think that debt issue is sufficiently consuming and polarized that whatever sort of longer-term investments of the type that the Bowles-Simpson Commission mentioned with respect to generating future growth are going to be set aside for a while.
At this point, I want to quote a listener on Facebook, Dwight Guys, who writes, "Learned the right lessons. I'm afraid our political elites have been skipping class for most of the last few decades. Seriously, I can't remember a time when so many felt so pessimistic about our leadership and where they are taking this country. It's scary stuff." I have a question for both of you. What is your opinion about the quality of the policy debates whether in Washington or in Paris or Bonn, Berlin. What is your opinion of the quality of the debate, the way that we are framing this challenge, discussing it? How about you first, Michael?
My view is that we're in a transition, that we're at a crossroads in the global economy. We were the dominant economy for most of the post-war period. Our habits of thought in the way we frame issues have a great deal to do with sort of the fact that most of the really important forces that operate in our economy, technological and so on, were internal. And I just don't think, you know, we'll make it eventually. We're fairly pragmatic people, but we're still in the habit of sort of thinking of ourselves as free of global forces, global pressures, structural change. We're frankly not very good at thinking about the sort of policy side of structural change. So I wouldn't characterize it so much as hopeless as kind of a transition.
And Simon, what do you think about the debate as it's unfolding right now? Are we very good at discussing these issues?
No, we're obviously quite bad. I think Michael's got a good point with the transition angle, but I would take it a little bit further and say that while the U.S., during the process of decline of the U.S. in relative position, obviously the U.S. has continued to grow, other countries have risen, both the Europe rebuilt after World War II, and then the developing countries became richer and more dynamic in terms of growth over the past 40 years. During that period, the U.S. dollar has remained the predominant reserve currency, and other countries have, as they've accumulated savings, they wanted to put part of that savings into a rainy day fund, into a dollar fund, and that has funded our debt habit. So it's very interesting and ironic and actually ultimately disturbing that when the post-war currency system, the so-called Bretton Woods system, broke down in the early 1970s, a lot of people said, oh, this is the end of American predominance. This is going to be a big shift in what the U.S. can do and in the deficits that we could finance. Remember, we had significant deficits in the 1960s during the Vietnam War. Those deficits were trivial compared to what we've run subsequently because the world has funded our habit. And this feeds into Michael's point about pragmatic. The United States is a very pragmatic country, very pragmatic in terms of thinking. But when the debt markets say to you, hey, go ahead and borrow, 10-year rates go down to 2.9%, there's no signal to the policymakers that they're really up against the wall. And I think Congress in particular, the executive branch has got something to do with this, but Congress over the past 40 years has gone absolutely nuts on the budget. And they've lost all sense of fiscal responsibility. And they've not got it back, despite the rhetoric of this week and the coming presidential campaign.
Well, Simon and Michael, Sean is calling from Des Moines, Iowa, and I think with a question about exactly this issue. Sean? Welcome.
Hi,
to On Point. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks. I was wanting to just ask them kind of about the general situation with the budget and deficit talks here in America and in D.C. Specifically, the Republicans seemingly want to have no tax increases, only tax cuts, and kind of just their general take on which one works more or more efficiently, and that, you know, tax cuts have never seemed to really create that many jobs, and that people who get the tax cuts tend to just pay to pay off the debt, and then those in the upper classes can generally, and corporations can pass it on to shareholders, where tax increases have seemed to work for governments like Germany and stuff that have a high amount of taxes and have a distinguished, societal structure. And then also how this economy, how it is possibly just a structural problem that we've seen in the diminishing middle class that doesn't have the purchasing power like it has before to kind of buy our way out of this recession.
Well, Michael Spence, you've certainly written in your new book about the disappearing middle class. But first, what's your answer to Sean's question? And I think it's one that many people have right now as a result of this highly partisan debate. What's the thing with taxes? Should tax cuts be called for now? Should tax increases be off the table or what?
Well, I certainly wouldn't recommend tax cuts. The kind of first order job is to remove the deficits so that the government financial situation is stable, that we can withstand an interest rate increase. We're not, and you know, there's a variety of ways to do that. And so let me just make the point. The one thing on which I think there's general agreement is over some reasonable period of time we should get rid of these large deficits, and then we diverge. We start to disagree, you know, a huge amount on how to do it. You know, that has to do with people's views of the size of government and a whole lot of other things. My own view is that, you know, once you've agreed on sort of stabilizing the deficit, we're going to have to argue our way and compromise our way through this wide variance of views on the other question. And but the thing that I think will get lost is this notion that, you know, we have an employment problem that and a growth problem to some extent, and it's going to require some level of investment in things that we've let slip. I mean, this is an economy in a low interest rate environment that saves below even reasonable levels for advanced economies and doesn't really kind of invest at levels that are designed to sort of sustain growth. So, you know, I guess I think the answer is the main determinants of longer term growth are not going to be primarily, you know, the result of this debate about tax cuts and whatnot. The one thing that would kill it is if we try to stabilize the budget too quickly. You know, we're operating in an economy that's short of domestic aggregate demand because the households sector, which wasn't saving anything at all, is now saving again, which is on balance a good thing, but it does leave us with a problem with having the domestic economy as a growth engine, and that's going to take time to go away. So it's easy to see, I think, that the government could exit, you know, in terms of, you know, reducing deficits too quickly. But after that, I think the issues have more to do with education, infrastructure, you know, longer term things.
And I want to get to that in a minute. But Simon Johnson, I think that, you know, many listeners, what they hear from this debate in Washington is this black and white discussion of taxes, whether there should be tax increases or not. And yet Michael Spence says that debate maybe is not even germane in the long run. What's your advice for people that are trying to make sense of this tax debate?
Simon. Well, yes, that's a good question, because I think the debate is somewhat at odds with reality. It's very interesting on taxes, Tom, because you talk to people on the left and the right, they agree that what we really need in the U.S. is tax reform, and particularly shifting taxes away from taxing income towards taxing consumption, and doing that in a way that isn't regressive, that doesn't hit hard people at the lower end of the income scale. There's a lot of agreement on that. The main reason the Republicans and other people on the right don't want tax reform, at least my conversations with them, is they don't want the extra revenue. So you could easily make the system more efficient at the same level of revenue, the same amount of tax relative to GDP, and that would be a good thing. But their fear is that if you did that, it would make it easier to raise more revenue. And actually, a lot of the debate is not about tax and not even about deficits, because ultimately we have to bring those under control. I think people, really reasonable people, more or less agree on that. It's about the size of government relative to the economy. How much government spending you want, how much do you want education or infrastructure provided by the government versus provided by somebody else, and who is that somebody else, and why would they provide education for everyone? That, I think, is actually the heart of the debate.
Carl from Ithaca, New York, is there a point that you can make real quickly before we go to our next break?
I guess perhaps that I've never been so depressed by the quality of the dialogue in our government. I mean, I've seen opportunity after opportunity to create infrastructure, to have what's called vision. And really, we've had no vision in this country as far as projects that will create wealth in the future, because it's all about right now. And I think the public needs a tremendous education. And, I mean, look what happened in World War II. We rationed gasoline, didn't we? I read a story about FDR when the automobile companies went to him. He said, we need X number of military vehicles in a year. They said, well, we can't. We have to produce cars. He said, we're not producing. At the beginning of World War II, not the Depression. He said, you don't understand. You're not going to build cars. We didn't build any more cars until 1946. I don't see anybody willing to take a strong hand. And the general public,
Carl. All right, I think that these gentlemen might agree with you. We're discussing the hot political battles in Washington, in Athens, and in Europe. I'm Tom Gjelten, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking debt crisis and the hard political battles being fought over the right way forward. My guests are Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, now a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and a professor at MIT, and Michael Spence, Nobel Prize-winning economist, chairman of the Commission on Growth and Development, and a distinguished fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. You know, both of you gentlemen sound so sensible and smart, and you talk about things that should be pragmatic solutions to where we are and where we should be going forward. And yet it seems like that aspect of this debate is so often missing. And I'm thinking, for example, something that you just said, Simon. You talked about the need to consider some consumption tax increases. I think you've written in favor of a value-added tax. And you have as well, Michael Spence. And yet, it seems that nobody with a sense of what's realistic is willing to talk about something like a value-added tax. What is it that explains why ideas that have a lot of support among professional people don't seem to really get much traction in this debate? Michael Spence, what do you think?
You know, I wish I knew the answer to that. I guess a little at it. I think, in some sense, you know, going down the wrong track usually there's some misperception about the way the world works, and you know, but it's still, I have to admit, it's, you know, I agree completely with Simon. Almost everybody agrees that our tax system would benefit from simplification. It could be done in such a way that it doesn't change the total amount of revenue, and yet that, and you know, the speed of withdrawal or fiscal stimulus and a lot of other things seem to be hijacked by this very deep division about the appropriate size and role of government.
Simon, you must get discouraged when you hear these complicated issues get simplified and demagogued the way I think politicians on all sides are tend to do, don't you think?
No, I'm not particularly discouraged, Tom. I think this is the way the democratic politics works. And I think eventually we will have to confront the reality, which is over a long period of time, we have one major spending issue, which is healthcare spending. And it's not just the government-funded part of healthcare spending. It's all of healthcare spending relative to the economy. Over a 30 to 50-year horizon on the current projections, this is going to ruin us. That's the spending side. And everybody who dances around says, oh, we should cut spending and so on and so forth. Unless they have a solution for limiting healthcare costs as a percent of the economy, then they're just ignoring the real problem. That's the spending side. On the revenue side, we have a big problem. If you don't want to raise revenue, then you're going to be you have to contract government. You will not be able to provide the kinds of benefits, Social Security and other benefits that you do currently. There are relatively easy ways, non-distortionary ways, to raise some revenue, not massive amounts of revenue. You have to control spending. There's no question about that. But some tax reform over a 10-year period, I think, will increasingly be taken seriously as a policy issue. Not right now, it's true. Right now, it's all about the symbols. And going into the presidential election 2012, I'm sure there will be a lot of confused discussion of the symbols. But after that, perhaps we'll get closer to the reality. The main risk, frankly, is that too many people around the world will lend us too much money for too long. And this is known as being given enough rope to hang yourself.
So we're going to need to wait until after the elections in 2012 before we have a real serious policy discussion here.
Yes, that's my read. In fact, I think the presidential election may push us back a bit because the so-called Bush-era tax cuts that are due to expire at the end of 2012 will almost certainly be renewed because the presidential candidates will vie with each other to say how they're not going to remove those tax cuts. And that's a problem because in terms of actual policies you could really get through that would make a first-order difference to the trajectory of deficits over the next decade, those tax cuts are absolutely the top item that people should be focusing on.
And let's go now to some of our listeners who have a lot of thoughts on these issues. First, to Jason, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Jason, welcome to On Point.
The problem is you have two Keynesian economists who would never even see the problem coming, let alone solve it. Here in the United States, if we were serious about talking about deficit reduction, we would pull away from our colonizing empire that we've maintained around the world, costing over $1 trillion a year. Secondly, as for Greece, you know, the same guy from Goldman Sachs who cooked Greece's books and hid debt to get them approved for the European Union is now the same guy from the IMF trying to push austerity measures. I mean, all this is going to collapse. Fiat money has been tried before and it will collapse. In the United States, the best thing we could have done is maintained our policy towards a constitution that provided government checks and balances on spending by only allowing them to spend what they had saved in gold or backed by gold and silver. That's how you solve this problem. Everything is eventually going to default here.
Michael Spence, how do you feel about being called a Keynesian economist?
Well, it's sort of rather flattering. I mean, I don't. First of all, I'm mostly a microeconomist, but I don't think of myself as a Keynesian. I think most of my colleagues, regardless of where they are on various macroeconomic policies, think that the Keynesian response was appropriate in the middle of the crisis, but after that, we've seen the part company on, and I certainly don't believe that, you know, we can restore growth by some kind of Keynesian attempt to achieve escape velocity. That's a model that I don't sign up to at all.
Well, of course, true classic Keynesians believe that stimulus spending will, fiscal spending will stimulate the economy. And yet, Simon Johnson, you're not exactly an advocate of wanton spending at this point, are you?
No, I'm the former chief economist of the IMF. I'm absolutely on the side of fiscal responsibility and being careful. I do think that the caller made a couple of good points. At some points, I don't agree with also. But what we do around the world, the U.S. military presence is very expensive, including the foreign wars, including the fact that we have 11 nuclear aircraft carrier groups, and nobody else in the rest of the world has any. I don't know if 11 is too many or too few, but it is kind of crazy to finance that spending by selling bonds to the Chinese, who are not, as far as at least when I listen to them, they're not particularly our friends in big geopolitical strategic terms. So certainly addressing military spending makes a lot of sense. And if you're willing to put military spending on the table right now for cuts, I would be absolutely open to that. I think that would be very sensible. The caller also pointed out that Goldman Sachs and other investment banks helped Greece build up a lot of debt. And that's true. And also those banks are now pushing or part of the pressure for Greece to have austerity. And that's also true. And we should take from that the very important lesson that financial markets are not your friend. Financial markets will lend you money when you need it, and sometimes that's appropriate, but they will also lend you far too much money, and they will turn against you, and they will pound on you, and you should expect exactly the same thing in the United States. However, on the Constitution and the fiscal side of the Constitution, I think that the caller has to go back and read more history, because that's absolutely not my interpretation of what happened in what was worked out in Philadelphia between May and September of 1787. I've read carefully the record. I've looked at the debates. I've looked at the papers of the people who were involved. I'm afraid that the caller's interpretation of the fiscal stance and the fiscal authority, the taxation authority that was being granted to a federal government, was very clear. That was one of the biggest political decisions made in 1787 and ratified by all the states.
Well, in fact, we have another perspective now from Jared, who's calling from Geneva, New York. Jared, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd just like to comment that this little factoid or what have you has been circulating forever, and that is that Bill Gates has so much money in his bank account, and you could tax that guy 90% of what he has in assets and just cash, probably just cash on hand, he'd still have hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because you can look at the National Football League and do the same thing with just the owners. And it would just knock the edge off this whole big-time debt, because you're talking trillions of dollars. And that's my comment.
Well, so you have a lot of faith that tax increases, at least for the wealthy, would go a long way to solve the deficit problem. But what effect would it have on economic growth, Michael Spence?
You know, I think that the focus on the sort of top 1% is somewhat misplaced. I mean, I believe that, you know, in a well-worked sort of social contract, you could tax
You know, Michael, I think I'm hearing what you're saying. I think you said that the focus on this is misplaced. But what we're going to do, if you could stand by, we're going to try and call you back because we're having a little bit hard time hearing you, Simon. You've been asked this, I'm sure, many times. What about this idea that if we could just tax the wealthy, we'd sort of solve the problem?
No, you don't solve the problem, unfortunately. Well, fortunately, unfortunately, the Bush tax cuts are an interesting case in point. I actually argued back in November and December we should not extend those tax cuts either for the so-called wealthy or for the middle class. Now, that made me pretty unpopular with many people. But if you just look at the numbers, the Congressional Budget Office puts out very clear numbers on this. If you want to really make a dent over the next 5 to 10 years in the deficit and therefore, of course, in the debt, you need to raise taxes. That's what it is. You need to raise taxes on both the wealthy and the non-wealthy. And if you think that going back to 90% marginal tax rates on very rich people is a good idea, I have to remind you that in the 1960s, the rich paid very little tax, even though we had very high marginal rates, because there are many ways to get around those tax rates. And I really think that this is a red herring. It's about what the middle class saves, what the middle class pays, what kind of government you want, what taxes you're willing to pay to finance and sustain that government, and how long you want to run crazy deficits selling the bonds to the Chinese, the Brazilians, and the Russians, and hoping that they never want to be paid back.
Okay, Simon, I'm going to put you on the spot again. Tom has a question for you. He's calling from Buffalo, New York. Tom, welcome to On Point.
Hi, gentlemen. Great conversation. I was wondering, Simon, you had mentioned that, and perhaps after more hearing of what you had to say and other callers and bring more to the table, you had spoke that health care was the number one issue. Yet defense and the Bush tax cuts are what have gotten us to this point. And in fact, in 20 years from now, they're going to go up exponentially and be the end-all, be-all of our debt. And I don't understand how you can put down the fact that in the 50s, which the conservatives love to go back to because they think that's where we live, there was a 90% tax, high tax rate, and everything was all hunky-dory to them. But now they want zero tax rates, and we've always had this problem every time there was a Republican president until now, where they just imploded the government before Obama could get in. There's no way, even if he gets 8 years, he has a chance to pull out of this one. But Clinton did it. I mean, I don't understand the logic.
Okay, Simon, explain your logic, Simon.
Okay, it's a good question, and there's a couple of pieces to it. First of all, let me be clear. The large deficits were run during the second Bush administration. Those were partly about the tax cuts. It was also about the military spending. So roughly speaking, national debt goes from $5 trillion to $10 trillion during that episode. And then, of course, we have the financial crisis, which was brought about by excessive liberalization of the financial sector and a lot of risk-taking. And when that blows up, it has massive fiscal costs because the economy goes down and you run a deficit because that's what happens when you lose the tax revenue and you pay unemployment benefit. And that pushes the debt from, say, $10 trillion to, roughly speaking, $15 trillion. So historically speaking, the caller is right that defense and the Bush tax cuts and the financial crisis, I would emphasize, played a really critical role in bringing us to this point. When you look forward over the next decade in terms of steps you can actually take to limit spending, you could certainly curtail military spending. I'm in favor of that, if we can agree on how to do that. You can address taxes, reform the taxes. That will make a big difference. You could perhaps limit other forms of so-called discretionary domestic spending, but those are very small relative to overall budget spending in this country. It's as you look out 20, 30, 50 years in the projections from the Congressional Budget Office, healthcare spending is what goes up to a very great degree. You see that in Medicaid, you see it in Medicare, and that's a big budget issue. But just shoving it off the government onto the private sector, saying, okay, businesses can now pay or individuals can now pay, that does not solve the problem, unfortunately, because those higher healthcare costs, actually, they would be even higher, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Pushing it away from the government will raise the cost for individuals and raise the cost for the economy. So that's why you have to talk about healthcare spending over a long period of time. And with regard to taxes, look, I'm in favor of everyone paying fair taxes, and I know many people who are richer than I am who would be okay paying somewhat higher taxes. But just saying we can tax the rich like we did in the past is not historically accurate. The fiscal responsibility in the 1950s was not about very high rates of taxation on the rich and having them pay for the entire burden of government. It was about broad-based middle-class taxes. And actually, the reason they brought marginal rates down was because no one was paying them. The rich found many ways to structure their income and their investments so they didn't pay taxes. And I personally don't think you want to go back to chasing the rich around with 90-95% marginal rates. I think we all have to step up and pay the taxes, or we can agree to have less government. Maybe you don't want the government to run airports. Maybe you don't want the government to run education. Maybe you don't want there to be any Social Security. That's a fine debate to have, by the way. Personally, I would raise the cap on the level at which you pay Social Security contributions.
Simon,
that's
Simon,
a fair way to do
me,
that.
Excuse me, Simon. I want to get, we're almost to the end. I want to get a final thought here from Michael Spence, who's back with us. Michael, what's your final thoughts on the way forward here?
I think that we will have to muddle through and compromise our way through to a plan over 5 years to restore the federal budget to zero. Simon's referred several times to borrowing money from the from foreigners, including the Chinese. You know, that's a different deficit. He knows that perfectly well. That's the current account deficit, and we're not, I don't think, you know, on a trajectory to reduce that. And that really, again, has to do with the kinds of structural challenges that I tried to talk a bit about in the book.
Let me just put in a plug for your book, because we're at the end of our hour. It's The Next Convergence, The Future of Economic Growth in a Multi-Speed World. That's Michael Spence. He joined us from Milan, Italy. We also heard from Simon Johnson. Thank you very much, both of you. Simon, you're the former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Thanks to both of you for joining us. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.